Well, good evening. Thank you very much for being here tonight. I know there are some that have driven a little ways to be here. Your presence is appreciated. Some of you have been here for every service, which was about 4 hours on Sunday, about 2 hours yesterday. By the time I get done tonight, it'll be about 4.5 hours today. Just kidding. Not really. We do appreciate your presence. It's encouraging to us that are speaking. It's encouraging to the church here. And we hope that the things we've talked about have edified you, have helped you to secure your faith and given you encouragement that there is reason for the things that you believe. We've been mentioning questions. We're going to do a Q&A tomorrow night. There are note cards out in the back if you'd like to write a question on. And just to be clear, we'd like to have those tonight so that we can think about them tomorrow and be able to give you a good response, or at least as good as we're capable of giving. So if you've got questions for any of us or all of us, if you will, just write them down. You can give it to one of Bruce, myself, or Tyler, one of the elders, Ross, and we'll try to get a hold of those and answer them to the best of our ability. There have been some who've had small children here every night and have stayed for the second session. And I tell you, I know that's not easy, and we certainly appreciate you doing that. I want to talk with you tonight to close this thing out about some of the outcomes, the consequences of believing in the atheistic worldview. Taking that particular worldview, this is kind of the so what of all the things that we've talked about this week. And I think this is something that is worth our while to consider. You know, sometimes we might have a conversation in which we take different sides of an issue and we get through with the conversation and we realize the differences weren't quite as big as maybe we thought they were at first. That is not the kind of conversation we're having when we're describing these two different worldviews, the atheistic worldview and the theistic worldview. What we're talking about are distinctions that are so fundamental that they essentially present mankind as two different species. Now think about that with me for just a moment. According to the atheistic worldview, man came to be as we are now through a process we call Darwinian evolution. Now there's a difference between atheism and evolution, but evolution is the mechanism that the atheist uses to explain life as we see it today. And according to the atheistic worldview, life as we see it today came to be because of a series of undirected occurrences that somehow, despite their randomness, produces order. So you and I, humanity, are just the most recent descendants of single-cell organisms whose sole purpose is to ensure the continuation of the species. No one wanted us to be what we are. No one had purpose for us. It just kind of happened. It just kind of developed. Random chance and natural selection. The biblical worldview, theism, presents mankind in a very different way. According to the theistic worldview, man is the result of the purposeful design of an intelligent being. That's a distinctly different concept. There's a reason that we exist. We are more than just this material husk that stands before you, that we see and interact with. There's something more important about us. We are a tripartite being, body, soul, and spirit. We are made in the image of a Creator, an all-powerful Creator, no less. And our purpose, our goal, is to serve Him. And if we're to believe the Bible, that service is going to lead to an eternal life with Him. And it's for that reason God made mankind. So our existence has purpose. Our lives are more important than just this moment or just the propagation of the species. Atheism is interesting to me, and Bruce talked about this some last night, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about this tonight. Atheism removes any foundation for an objective morality. Now, I want to be very clear when I say that atheism removes the foundation for an objective morality. I am not saying that atheists cannot behave in a moral way. That's simply not true. I would say, as Brother Reeves said last night, they do so in spite of their atheism. One popular thinker and speaker that you may be hearing about today, Jordan Peterson, he was asked if he believed in God, and he kind of equivocated a little bit. He said, I'm not sure, but I do my best to live as if there is one. In other words, I recognize there's consequences to my actions. I don't know why there's consequences, but I recognize that, and so I try to live my life in a particular way. So the atheist can certainly live a moral life. The problem is there's no objective standard in atheism and an atheistic worldview that would define morality. Non-material concepts such as good or evil have no objective basis in an undirected world. If there is no ultimate standard, what does good even mean? What could evil be? If there's no standard of goodness that's unmovable and outside of ourselves to compare an action or a concept to, why would we be moral? What would that mean? And so in the atheistic worldview, morality, as you may think about it, it arises from personal bias. In other words, from what seems to be best at the moment. I'm not going to commit murder because if I do, someone will take me and kill me, and that's really not good for me. It's not that murder is wrong or evil, but it can become very inconvenient. That would be the foundation of an atheistic moral. They'll tell us that morality, as Brother Reeves pointed out last night, is the product of a community of thinkers. We'll talk some more about that idea in just a moment. Theism does something very different. Theism offers a true standard upon which we can base a true objective morality. A thing is not good or bad because I think it's good or bad. It really has nothing to do with me. Instead, we're talking about how a thing reflects or fails to reflect the nature of God. A thing is either good or evil based upon its relationship to God's character. So we have an objective standard that has nothing to do with an individual's desires. What I think about the thing has nothing to do with whether or not it's good or evil. Its relationship to God's character determines whether or not it's good or evil. So we have a standard that all of us can appeal to, and we can do that equally, so that we can understand what ought to be done, what ought not to be done. And I'm afraid what's happened in this country, and I'm sure in others, over the past 100, 150 years, is that good people, people who believe in God, are often quiet, sometimes a little passive. We're not interested in entering the public arena often. We don't want to be combative with people. And so we've kind of taken, I'm afraid, a live and let live approach. And so ideas that on their face make no sense are being taught in our schools. And I think it's time that we're willing to stand up. And this is so much of what we're trying to get across today. That we're willing, in a kind and loving, compassionate way, to confront people. To just ask the next question. To push people a little bit when they tell us that we all know that evolution is true. What do you mean we all know that evolution is true? What makes you think that evolution is true? What about some of the problems? And we'll notice some here in just a moment. When we say theism, what we're talking about is a belief in the existence of a God, or God specifically. Belief in the existence of one God viewed as the creative source of the human race and the world who transcends yet is immanent in the world. We're talking about God, the concept of a God, more specifically, the God that we read about in the Bible. When we talk about atheism, we could literally define that term as a disbelief in the existence of deity, but that's really not all we're confronting today. What we see most of the time today, what's being taught taught or pushed in our universities oftentimes, what you're going to see on YouTube, if you're out watching things on YouTube, are what we might call the new atheist. And it's a little bit different. New atheism is characterized by a materialistic naturalism. Let me explain what that means. It's the idea that the only thing that exists is matter, that all things are composed of material, and all phenomena are the result of material interactions and are governed solely by natural laws and forces as opposed to supernatural or spiritual. In other words, all that is what we can see. That there's nothing outside of the natural world, and that everything that we see is the result of the interaction of natural things or those things in the natural world. I believe that the worldview of atheism has three devastating consequences that need to be considered. And we need to talk about these things with our friends and with our neighbors who may not believe in God. Number one, the atheistic worldview, and I'm sure any atheist you've talked to would reject this wholeheartedly, but I'll show you why I say this. The atheistic worldview essentially destroys the concept of reason. I'm going to show you why I say that. Secondly, the atheistic worldview, and we've already kind of touched on this, removes any purpose or sense of purpose from humanity. And I think that's a devastating thing. And then finally, as a result of that, we see the total degradation of humanity. And so this is a devastating worldview, not just because it disagrees with the Bible, but because of the way it destroys our ability to even consider what might be best for us on really any level above the immediate. Let's talk about this idea of the destruction of reason. Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Enemies of Reason, famously said, "Reason has built the modern world." This is kind of a common theme among those who view the world through the atheistic lens. Reason is to be cherished above all else, and when you properly apply reason, there's no room left for God. What Richard Dawkins would tell you if you were here right now is that if you were reasonable people, what you would do is you would leave this church, you would forget about God, and you would in that somehow find freedom. That's what he would have you to believe in those who are like him. And he would base this all on the idea of reason. If you were just reasonable, if you just thought a little bit, you'd ignore all this religious nonsense. Madeline Murray O'Hare, she puts it this way. She says, "Atheism is based upon a materialist philosophy which holds that nothing exists but natural phenomena," that naturalism we talked about. "There are no supernatural forces or entities, nor can there be any. Nature simply exists." She goes on to say, "The atheist must slice through all the obfuscation," one of my favorite words in the English language, just because it's fun to say. But I want you to remember that she says this, because that's the idea of clouding the issue, right? We're going to cloud the issue so you can't see the kernel of truth that you really need to see. "The atheist must slice through all the obfuscation to bedrock, to the basic idea that those who regard nature as primary and thought as property or function of matter belong to the camp of materialism, and that those who maintain that spirit or idea or mind," boy, hold on to that word, "existed before nature or created nature or uphold nature belong to the camp of idealism. All conventional religions are based on idealism." There's a whole lot of obfuscation going on here. Because there's a question, and I would suggest you remember this question, because I think it's a really good question to ask anyone who's a naturalist, who's an atheist in that modern day sense. And that question is, where did we get the mind? Not the brain, not the physical structure housed in the cranium that you can see on an MRI. Consciousness. The ability to process information. The ability to reason. Where did we get it? Hold on to that for just a moment. Richard Feynman, a physicist who is actually quite noted for being able to take complicated concepts and boil them down very simply and express them where, you know, folks like me can understand what he's saying. He took what Madeline Murray O'Hare said. Well, I guess he kind of predated her, but he takes that same concept. And he put it this way, my favorite quote in the whole night. "All things are made of atoms, and everything that living things can do, everything that living things do can be understood in the terms of the jigglings, wigglings, of atoms. And yes, I chose that just so I could say jigglings and wigglings in the pulpit and get away with it. But that kind of makes it simple, doesn't it? Everything that you see can be explained. Everything that is can be explained by atoms slapping together. And if you can't explain it by atoms slapping together, it doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. It doesn't work. There's nothing to worry about. But Charles Darwin, on the other hand, goes, wait a minute, fellas. He says, with me the horrid doubt always arises whether the conviction of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the conviction of a monkey's mind if there are any convictions in such a mind? And here's the point that I'm driving at. The materialist, the naturalist, this atheistic worldview has to rely on the mechanism of evolution, typically Darwinian evolution, which talks about these undirected changes where we go from a single cell organism up to a more complex organism until what we might call some sort of animal. And then finally you have a certain branch of monkeys coming down out of the tree and they develop a little bit, and then you get Homo sapiens and it's you and me. And Darwin says, I'm a little afraid that if I'm right, I would have had no way of figuring this out. Why? Because monkeys can't think like this. And what Darwin is admitting is that his theory has nothing in it that accounts for our mind. Not our brain, our mind. And he really knows that, hey, I've got nothing to add to that. So if I'm right, I don't know why I'm right, and I probably shouldn't be right, but I think I'm right. Sounds reasonable. So the atheist appeal to reason is the grounds of their position. This reasoning leads them to naturalism. The naturalism can't explain the reasoning that got them to naturalism. Kind of like getting stuck on a merry-go-round, isn't it? Only way to get off the jump, right? That seems to be a problem to me. The very people that say you and I only believe what we believe about God and our worldview because we don't use reason cannot explain to you where, how, or why they're able to reason. Seems like a problem. Most southern name I've ever seen. Carson, that guy. In his book, True Reason, said if human reasoning evolved naturally, it is because it helped human beings survive and reproduce. Does this give us any basis for trusting our reasoning ability when it comes to questions of cosmology or quantum mechanics or neuroscience? Not at all. At best, our cognitive faculties would be reliable when it comes to finding berries or using a spear against an enemy or doing something to attract a mate. In other words, if Darwin's right, in our minds, our brains develop from those lower species, all we're supposed to be doing, according to Darwinian evolution, is protecting, preserving, and propagating the species. What does that have to do with abstract thinking? What does that have to do with the kind of reasoning that men like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking are noted for doing? Where would that ability come from in that Darwinian structure that they say is the only one that really makes any sense? If that's where we got our minds, what use do we really have for quantum mechanics? You ever use quantum mechanics to get food? I heard it's really effective, guys, if you're trying to find a date. Right? I mean, Why did we develop in that particular way? So the appeal to reason is the grounds of their position, leads them to naturalism, and naturalism kind of leaves us alone. And can I make a point to you? We've thrown a ton of information at you this week. We haven't even gotten to most of what's in our books. And you'll note the bibliographies at the end of each essay. We haven't even touched what you can find in those books. There is a ton more information out there. We're scratching the surface, barely. And yet, I know how you feel, because I know how I feel. A little bit overwhelmed, right? And some of you are probably thinking, well, this is all great, but I'll never remember all this stuff. Let me tell you something. You think I made those charts for you? I made them because I can't remember what I need to say next. It's a lot of information. And so you might look and you might say, but I don't have the education in the fields or this thing or that thing. And these other people, why these atheists that we read about, they're so intelligent and they're so educated and they use these big long words and these complicated concepts. Can I really push back on all this? Yes. And I say that as somebody who proudly graduated 35th in his high school class of 71 people. And if you want to know about my degree, it was college prep. That's as far as I went. I don't have a college degree. I'm a Coke man who started preaching in Bradley, Arkansas, and realized that was a better thing to do than sell Cokes. But here's what I know. I know if you can read and if you'll be patient and if you'll think a little bit, you can see through a lot of this stuff. I also know that in each one of these talks this week, there's a little tidbit you can take and put in your pocket and you can remember. Bruce talked about suffering last night. And there's a lot, you know, all those C.S. Lewis quotes, and you got to kind of chew on them a little bit. God allows suffering so that we can love Him. Suffering is the product of choice. Without choice, there is no love. That's something I can hold on to. Tyler drew the short straw on subject matter. He got the most boring subject matter, and he does a phenomenal job presenting it in a way that's engaging. And most of it I'm listening to, and it's just rolling right out one ear, you know, in one ear and out the other. But that chart he put up there, where he talked about Homer and Plato and the New Testament manuscripts, that is a powerful, powerful chart. And I think I can remember that. That the Bible, we've got about 24,000 manuscripts, and there are manuscripts that get within about, I think he said 29 to 82 years, I always kind of cut it in half, about 50 years. And the next closest that we have from these works from antiquity is you know, a handful of copies, I think 69 copies, 500 years from the original writing. I'll stand with that all day long. And we talked about scientific evidences. The one that always sticks out to me is irreducible complexity. You get that DNA out there. There's so many things you have to transmit information. If you take one of those things out, information cannot be transferred. You can't have DNA. You can't have life. So these little concepts, little ideas you can take and put in your pocket, and you can remember, and don't let all the big words and all the fancy concepts throw you off. There are these simple questions that we need to be asking that are worth our while to ask. We're talking about reason. Let's talk about reason and theism. Biblical worldview. Man is made intentionally in the image of a rational being. Abstract concepts such as morality and logic, they have a solid foundation. We have something to ground them in that gives us a starting point from which to move forward. There's some basis for the things that we're thinking. There's certain concepts that are so necessary. Morality, I would even argue logic, that are essential. And we're not left to just stumble over them. Instead, they are revealed to us by the One who created us. That reasonable and intelligent being who created us in His image. You see, all this is cohesive. All of this works together. This makes a sort of sense that we would be able to reason and think the way that we are, considering where we came from, if a theistic worldview is correct. Let me explain what I mean. You know, we might ask, where do the laws of logic come from? The atheist has got an interesting answer, kind of like his answer regarding morality. The atheist will typically say that logic came from a community of thinkers throughout the years. They kind of conceived of the laws of logic. And by the way, this is an example you will see oftentimes of a little trick you'll see a lot when you're listening to atheists talk. They do the same thing with that question about the mind. I watched dozens of YouTube videos where maybe there was a debate between a theist and an atheist, or maybe an atheist was being interviewed. If someone would ask them, according to your worldview, where did the mind come from? And they would answer the question, but they never talk about where the mind came from. They'd answer the question by talking about where the brain came from. And it'd be this subtle little shift. And if you're not paying attention, boy, they can talk at length about where they think the brain came from. But if you press them a little bit, no, I didn't ask about the brain. Where'd the mind come from? Thoughts are electrical. Where did the mind come from? They don't have an answer. They don't have an answer. Where did the laws of logic come from? Boy, they'll jump on that. Community of thinkers. No. It's another little shift. What they're telling you is where the descriptions of the laws of logic came from. I don't care what we call them. Where did the principles of logic come from? A community of thinkers? Well, what principles of logic did they use to think up the principles of logic? You see the problem? And I am afraid sometimes we're intimidated by degrees and pedigrees and vocabulary, and we don't recognize, hey, this guy doesn't have an answer. He just doesn't have an answer. So we don't need to be ashamed. Common sense, every man thinking, goes a long way if we're willing to just ask the next question. Or maybe press a little bit. I didn't ask why we call them what we call them. When did those laws start and where did they come from? I think that's an important thing for us to think about. Let me give you an example. One of the first laws of logic that we might talk about if you're in a logic class, the law of non-contradiction. Oh, here we go with big words and fancy phrases. This is really simple. A cannot be A and not A at the same time. I know it's late. That probably sounds a little silly, but think about that. I cannot be me and not me at the same time. I cannot be Sean Chancellor and Tyler Sams at the same time. And Tyler's offering a prayer of thanksgiving even as we speak. Right? I mean, that's just kind of common sense, right? I cannot be A and not A at the same time. So let's think about that in a grander scale. The universe cannot exist and not exist at the same time. How many people have to be alive for that to be true? You get that? If a community of thinkers came up with logic, that means people had to be existing, or existent, I guess, in order for the laws of logic to be true. That's ridiculous. That principle holds true if there was never any individual or human being. The universe cannot exist and not exist at the same time. And so what you see is this problem with reason that the atheistic worldview has, that the theistic worldview really takes care of. Because someone asked me, where do the laws of logic come from? That's God. You ever read your Bible and notice how logical it is? How there's no contradictions there? And if it is, it's one of these mistakes that we're talking about. It's a scribal error or something like that. What a beautiful concept. We see logic in the nature of God, and we can come to understand a lot about how the universe operates, how the life of the world around us operates by looking at the life of God. I won't take time to read Ecclesiastes chapter 1. I'm sure you're familiar with it. If you're not, you can go back and check that out on your own time. But I think that's an important point to make. The atheistic worldview removes purpose from the life of man. And this is really what Solomon ends up saying. You look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and starting there verse 12 down through about verse 18. And what you've got is really an early scientific experiment, maybe a social sciences experiment. And here you've got this man and he says, I want to find out what the value of practical atheism is. Not that Solomon denied there was a God, but he said, I'm going to live like there's not one. And if ever there was a man who had the ability to do that, it was Solomon. Solomon says, I'm just going to imbibe in whatever I want, and I'm going to get as much of it as I can handle, and I'm going to see what the result is. So he goes about and he lives in this life of practical atheism. And man, the book gets dark quick, doesn't it? Because what he says, and he kind of sums up his experiment and his conclusions in chapter 2, and when he comes along in chapter 2, he says, I looked at all these things, I did all these things, I tried all this stuff that the anti-God, the godless world would say is what life is all about, and here's what I found it to be. Vanity. You ever read through the book of Ecclesiastes and get in the middle of it and just get depressed? You kind of should. Because the writer of Ecclesiastes presents that life in that depressing way. Because that life leads to nothing. Of course, he ends that book. He says, what's the conclusion of the whole matter? What is it that man is intended to do? Fear God and keep His commandments. And so that drives us in a direction that gives value to our life. It gives meaning to our suffering. You look at the atheistic worldview and you look at the suffering in the world, and I think this is why they throw it out so much as an argument against God. You look at the atheistic worldview and you look at the suffering in the world and you go, well, what's this suffering good for? And the only answer you come up with is nothing. You ever seen teenage boys light a lighter and hold their hand over it? See how long they hold it there? Pretty stupid, right? I've done it too. Pretty stupid, right? It's pain for no point. What kind of dummy experiences pain for no point? Well, you eventually wise up and you learn that's not a good thing, right? But let me ask all the fathers out there. What pain would you not willingly take to save your child from suffering? See, pain with a purpose is a whole different thing. The atheist has us holding our hand over the lighter for no real reason. God says you may suffer, but there's an end to it. There's a purpose to it. There's a reason. And so we find value even in those things that are difficult to bear. The American Atheist Center says an atheist believes that only in a knowledge of himself and a knowledge of his fellow man can he find the understanding that will help to a life of fulfillment. So the better I understand the suffering of me and my friends, the better I'll enjoy it, even though what I'm going to find out is it's all for naught, there's no purpose, it's vanity. So this idea to me really doesn't take us any further. It doesn't get us anywhere of value. It doesn't give us any purpose. It's just the gathering of knowledge for the simple gathering of knowledge. Frank Zindler. The person who practices enlightened self-interest is the person whose behavioral strategy simultaneously maximizes both the intensity and duration of personal gratification. An enlightened strategy will be one which, when practiced over a long span of time, will generate ever greater amounts and varieties of pleasures and satisfactions. This is the atheistic model of morality, but I want you to notice what that does. It makes the only purpose that we have the pleasure of the moment. The pleasure of the moment. Bruce and Tyler and I were talking about aches and pains, and I know there's some of you that know a lot more about that than I do. But Bruce and I particularly were talking about how in our 20s people would tell us, you know, one day all these things are going to hurt. And we're like, yeah, right, man, I feel great. And then you get in your 30s and you go, I could see where that might happen. And then you get in your 40s and you're like, oh, yeah. That's a real deal, right? And I've got a feeling that's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better, right? How foolish is this purpose for living? I'm going to live to maximize pleasure. It's a self-defeating proposition. The suffering of this world will always outweigh the pleasures of this world. If all that I'm living for are worldly pleasures, I'm living for a commodity that is fast disappearing. What is the purpose of dealing with any of that? By the way, have you ever read any of the diaries of the Columbine shooters? Not the most pleasant reading that you'll ever do. You know what they tell you about why they did what they did? It's this right here. They didn't believe in God. They were looking at what they were doing as the only viable alternative because as they looked at the world around them and looked at it through Darwinian and atheistic eyes, they saw that they really had no purpose. Not only did they have no purpose, and they go into dark detail about this, not only did they have no purpose, but you and me don't have any purpose. And since we don't have any purpose, we shouldn't be here. You know what every school shooter, I think except one, has referenced since Columbine? in their manifestos that they leave behind. Those passages from the Columbine shooters. I'm not saying all atheists turn into school shooters. I am saying that the more we take value and purpose from our lives away, the more desperate we become. And the more open we become as individuals and as a society to otherwise unthinkable things. What a worldview. It's the worldview of Ecclesiastes 3:20. All came from the dust. All returned to the dust. Open your Bibles. That's enough depression. Look at Romans chapter 8. I love Romans chapter 8. There is therefore now no condemnation for those who walk in Christ Jesus. Coming on the heels of Romans chapter 7, where Paul describes the futility of trying to be justified through the law. There's this thing that I want, but I cannot have it. Why? Because I have sinned, and there's nothing in that law that can bring me back to God. And then we come to chapter 8 in verse 1, and all that's done away. There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Hope is presented. By the way, you can't have hope if you don't have a mind. And you can't reason. Paul says, here is hope. Hope for who? Hope for those who walk according to the law of the Spirit. He goes in detail in that in the first half of Romans chapter 12. He tells us that we're not left and abandoned by God. Instead, we can cry out by the Spirit, Abba, Father, because we're adopted as sons. Sons of God. The Spirit testifies with our spirit that that is true. In other words, I can read my Bible, look at my gospel, see value, see God's nature, see what God would have me to do to reflect those things. I can examine my life. I can see where I'm erring. I can come back to Him, and I can have expectation of a resurrection. There's value. There's something to long for. There's something to look for. Paul says there's going to be suffering. He goes on and he describes that there in that section between verses, 13 and 20, give or take. And he talks about how the creation longs and groans and waits for this change that God is going to bring upon it, this salvation that He's going to provide, this final redemption. He says in verse 23, not only this, but we also ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, that final step, the redemption of our body, that resurrection, when sin is fully and finally defeated, as death is destroyed, as that which sin has marked is brought up, changed, and perfected. Why should I suffer? Because this is my end. What purpose do I have? This resurrection, this final full redemption. Verse 24, for in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it. He saw a goal. He saw a goal that was worth attaining. He saw something that made everything else in his life worth overcoming. He saw value in his suffering because of the goal that it brought him closer to. It was a reason for the life that he lived. Let me tell you something else. And I think this is something we need to consider. And we need to impress on our young people. We need to impress it on our old folks too, I think. This hope offers mankind a useful outlet for our intellect. We've been talking about the mind. We've been talking about the ability to reason. We talked about the scientific method. I made a joke about air conditioning being my... It wasn't a joke, actually. I was being serious as I could. My favorite scientific invention, I'm glad I got it, but that's not why God gave us the brain, the mind, the intellect that we have. It hurts my heart when gospel preachers, Bible class teachers try to talk about subjects that are difficult within the Bible. I'll give you one in particular. A deep discussion about the nature of God. What do these things like omniscience and omnipresence and all these other attributes that we might talk about? I think there's a lot more than the three O's that we could discuss. What are those things? What does that look like reflected in God? And every time I've tried to have a deep discussion about that in a local church, I've gotten some faction of the church has said, "Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. We don't need to think that hard about those things." They go off and they quote a passage about the simplicity of the gospel that they haven't really looked at to understand. It doesn't mean easy to understand, but the word actually means singleness. And they tell me if it's that complicated, we shouldn't be thinking about it. What do you think you should be doing with the intellect that God gave you? If not to reason through His Word, and to use that gift that He blessed you with, to come to a deeper understanding of Him and of His kingdom and how you can serve Him in your life. I understand there are other pursuits that are necessary, but there's no other pursuit that is more essential. There's no other pursuit that should motivate us. There is no other pursuit that we should be more intellectually involved in and stimulated by. I think we give ground to the atheists when we just don't think about what the Bible says. Get off my soapbox. The atheistic worldview degrades mankind. Notice what Charles Darwin himself says. "The main conclusion here arrived at, and now held by many naturalists who are well competent to form a sound judgment, is that man is descended from some less highly organized form. The grounds upon which this conclusion rests will never be shaken, for the close similarity between man and the lower animals in embryonic development, as well as innumerable points of structure and constitution, both of high and of the most trifling importance, the rudiments of which he retains, and the abnormal reversions to which he is occasionally liable, are facts which cannot be disputed." You get what he's saying? You look out at the animal world and you go, "I'm better than at least the dog." No, you're not. You're the same thing. You just walk a little different. You have the same purpose. You probably just think about it a little more. But in essence, you are the same thing. And by the way, those embryonic drawings he's pointing to, they weren't even true embryonic drawings, by the way. This unshakable fact was based on incorrect information at best. So your humanity means nothing. And he goes on to point this out. He says, "We civilized men do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, and the sick. We institute poor laws, and our medical men exert their utmost skill to save the life of everyone to the last moment. Thus the weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. It is surprising how soon a want of care, or care wrongly directed, leads to the degeneration of a domestic race. But excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed." Was it 1.6 million abortions a year? And we look at it and we go, how can people do that? What do you mean it's not a life? You understand. In the atheistic worldview, the Darwinian evolutionary worldview, it doesn't matter if it's a life. They don't care that it's a life. Because life holds no intrinsic value. It's just something that's unwanted. How could someone possibly discard that? I'm not saying there's not emotional situations that occur around that decision. But when we look at how they get encoded in our national law, and we go, how could you kill someone? Don't they know it's a life? And you'll hear some arguments, well, maybe it is, maybe it is. They know it's a life. If they found on Mars what we find in a woman's womb within the first 2 weeks of her pregnancy, what do you think every news channel and every TV station in the world would be pronouncing? We found life. The real problem is this worldview that says life has no true value. Beyond the propagation and the protection of the species, we got plenty of people to get that done. Everything else is just gravy. If you don't want it, don't take it. What a terrible degradation of humanity. Richard Dawkins acknowledges this, his book, The Selfish Gene. My own feeling is that a human society based simply on the genes law of universal ruthless selfishness would be a very nasty society in which to live. But unfortunately, however much we may deplore something, it does not stop it being true. Here's another man who doesn't believe there's a God, but he sure lives like he does. He's saying, I don't want to live in the world that I think we live in. But we do. What a terrible concept of humanity. If man is the product of chance and random occurrence, an individual has no intrinsic value. All that matters is the species. The biblical worldview, again, presents us with something far different. Here we see each individual is a living soul made in the image of the Creator. This is the fundamental problem, by the way, with theistic evolution. It's a theological problem. God says we're made in the image of God. Theistic evolution says the one celled amoeba might have been, but you sure weren't. That's problematic on multiple levels. It's the special creation that gives mankind intrinsic value. You as an individual have value not because you're like me. This is one of the fundamental problems with racism, right? Racism says because I'm white, all the white people have more value than all the non-white people because they're more like me. That's not why any individual has value. You as an individual have value because you're made in the image of God. I as an individual have intrinsic value because I'm made in the image of God. It's far different from what Darwin would say, what the atheistic world would force upon us. And it's certainly something that we need to consider as we look out at this world that is becoming so much darker every day that we live, that is giving in to this theory, this worldview, seemingly more and more as time moves on. And as we see that happening, we cannot just give up. We cannot just say, that's how the world is. What are we going to do? Push back. Now, I think there was a time when if you came across an atheist, it was going to be someone who was so entrenched in their beliefs that you couldn't change their mind. But we're generations away from that now. We're at a point in time where there's generations of atheists who are coming up who have not thought it through. They were just born to atheist parents. It's just their tradition. Does that sound familiar? They've been pretty effective at culling the ranks of churches. The young people of churches who were just raised up in a tradition. Why couldn't we be effective in the same thing? Because we go and we ask difficult questions that maybe they haven't considered. And simply show them there's holes in what they're thinking. And there's reason for what we believe. Is it reasonable to believe in God? I hope this week we've shown you enough that you can say, absolutely. That my decision to believe in God is not founded on a blind leap in the dark that has no underpinning. But instead, we stand on a solid foundation of fact, of thinking, of logic, that's substantial. And if I'm standing on that undergirding, and it's led me to a point of conviction that there is a God, the next step seems to me to be a rather obvious step. There is an all-wise, all-powerful Creator who holds my life in His hand. I should submit to Him. I should come to know Him to the best of my ability. I should conform my life to His will. I should change anything that puts distance between me and Him. That all-powerful, all-wise Creator calls us to serve through His Son. You're here tonight, you're not a child of God, you've repented of your sins. Why not confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God with all that truly means, that you're willing to live your life for Him? Having done that, enter into the waters of baptism. Paul tells us in Colossians chapter 2, Jesus will meet you there and cut your sins away. The very power that raised Him from the grave will raise you a new creature, Romans chapter 6. Maybe there's something that you need the church here to pray for you over. Maybe you've repented of sins and you want them to go to God for you. Why not let this church know right now while we stand?